Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Asian American Studies, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Ian Shin. Today on our podcast, we have Professor David Atkinson speaking about his book, The Burden of White Supremacy, Containing Asian Migration in the British Empire and the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. David Atkinson is Associate Professor of History at Purdue University, where he is also Affiliate Faculty in American Studies in the School of Interdisciplinary Studies. He specializes in the history of U.S. foreign relations, diplomatic history, the history of migration, and international history. In our conversation, David and I spoke about his process for researching and writing a history that stretches across four continents. This ambitious and wide-ranging research sheds light on the local conditions and idiosyncrasies that define the restriction of Asian mobility across the Anglophone world in the early 20th century. I really enjoyed reading The Burden of White Supremacy and speaking about it with David Atkinson, and I hope that you enjoy our conversation. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Asian American Studies. I'm Ian Shin, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we're talking to David Atkinson about his book, The Burden of White Supremacy, Containing Asian Migration in the British Empire and the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. David is Associate Professor of History at Purdue University. David, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
David, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as your listeners can probably tell from my bizarre accent, I'm originally from the north of England. I'm from Leeds in the north of England. And I went to university in England, my undergraduate university in England, to Manchester University, where I studied American studies. And, you know, American studies in Britain is very much about politics, about history, about literature. So those were the kind of focuses of that study. But part of doing American studies in Britain means you get to do an exchange year in the United States. So I spent a year at George Washington University as an undergraduate. That was just transformative for me in terms of my interest in history and my specific interest in diplomatic history. So that was such a great experience. The other great thing about that experience was I met my American wife and ultimately moved to the United States. So I've lived in the States for close to 20 years now, and I did my PhD in the United States at Boston University from 2002 to I think 2010. And that was just a tremendous experience for me. I worked with an international historian there by the name of William Keeler, and who was just such a great mentor, if for nothing else, that he gave me carte blanche. I mean, I had an enormous amount of latitude, which is why this project is as capacious as it is. I mean, I think sometimes another mentor might have slowed me down or circumscribed me in some ways. Perhaps I would even circumscribe one of my own students and limit them in what they were trying to do. But Bill did not do that, and that let me run wild, as you can see. And then upon graduating, I was lucky enough to get this position at Purdue University, where I've now been for 7 years and nominally as the U.S. foreign relations historian. But as you can tell from this book, I think and teach and research much more broadly than that quite often.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And I would love to talk a little bit about the capaciousness of the topic and the research. But before we get to that, I'm curious how you came to become interested in diplomatic history. You mentioned that in American studies in Britain, that the study of that is very much focused on politics and history and literature. Is that what led you to an interest in diplomatic history, or how did you cultivate that particular topical interest?
You know, it's going to be a word that I will use an awful lot in the next hour or so, and that's contingency. And one of the contingencies of my life story was that I happened to be at George Washington University on this exchange program in 1996, 1997. And that was a tremendously fortuitous time to be there because they were doing some incredible work on internationalizing diplomatic history. So what was happening at the time was you had a lot of people, well, not a lot of people, but you had people who were able to get into Eastern European, post-Soviet Russian archives, Chinese archives, Vietnamese archives, and that was a real movement in the mid-90s. And that was transforming the study of the Cold War in ways that were just inconceivable 10 years before. And it just so happened that GW was at the center of much of this work. One of the history professors there, James Hirschberg, was directing the Cold War International History Project there at the time. And they were beginning to collate and organize and publish a lot of the primary sources from Eastern European archives and Russian archives, which was particularly useful because quite often there was a good deal of capriciousness about those archives. They would open and close arbitrarily, and all of a sudden things you were able to see you couldn't, and so on. So they were putting this material out there, and I was fascinated by that. Being able to do that kind of work. And on the other hand, they also still to this day have at George Washington University something called the National Security Archives, which does incredible work working on freedom of information requests, trying to fill in a lot of the gaps that we know are there in our understanding of American foreign relations, especially during the Cold War. And they were just turning up some incredible material. So it was just an incredibly fortuitous and exciting and dynamic place to be that really hooked me in particular on American foreign relations scholarship.
And how do you then see yourself teaching at the intersection of the history of U.S. foreign relations or U.S. diplomatic history and immigration, right? Which I think, as some of your the actors in your book would themselves say, is sort of the quintessential domestic issue of, who you allow to come into the country. How do you see these two different subfields of U.S. history interacting with one another today?
Well, I'll say first of all that everything I've just described, if you've read the book, makes no sense, right? Because I'm not a Cold War historian anymore. And what I quickly realized was that if you were going to do this kind of history, if you were going to work in a Cold War period, you were going to have to do some really, truly international scholarship. And I simply did not have the language skills. I couldn't work in Chinese or Polish or Hungarian or Russian. So and that wasn't likely that I was going to pick that up. So I actually, the genesis of me working in diplomatic history, the 19th century and migration came from another particularly fortuitous experience I had between moving to the United States and starting my PhD program. I worked at Harvard University as an administrator. And as part of that, I had the opportunity to take classes at Harvard as a kind of non-degree student. And I jumped at that opportunity. And one of the first classes I took was with Akira Irie, who, of course, is one of the absolute guiding lights of international history, of thinking about internationalizing American history, of the cultural turn in American history, of the transnational turn. So I just imbibed an incredible amount of fascinating insights from him over the course of that class. And one of the things I did for him in a paper there was I decided to get out of my comfort zone and do something quite different. And I wrote a paper for him on the Paris Peace Conference and the British Empire delegation at the Paris Peace Conference. And what I quickly discovered was this issue of Asian migration was at the center of most of their discussions, as I relay in chapter six of the book. So the genesis of the dissertation itself and the genesis of my interest in migration and diplomacy really came out of that experience with him. And I was really struck, by, you know, obviously what a global problem this was, but B, getting back to what you just described, I was really struck by the notion that we treated our, you know, this was the late 90s, early 2000s, we treated in the scholarship migration and immigration questions as very much domestic questions that are bound up in sovereignty and conversations about which take place within the nation state, not between nation states. And that was a fascinating point that really guided me here, because I discovered very quickly in the primary sources that was simply not the case, that quite often you'd have to discuss immigration and migration across borders because it was an international problem, an international issue. Anytime you've got people traversing borders, you've got an international or transnational issue. So that's how I actually got involved in this particular project.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about some of those issues in chapter six that you raise about the peace conferences later in the interview. To return quickly to what you said earlier about the sort of capaciousness of this book, it really is ambitious in so many ways. I think the sort of most obvious factor to readers and listeners will be its geographic scope, covering Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, and the U.S. So before we dig into the chapters, you know, for folks who are listening who may be writing their own dissertations or their own books, I wonder if you can talk a little bit about what it was like to do the research for this project. For example, did you begin with all of these sites in mind, or did some of these come earlier than others, and how did they sort of put together into this book as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, it was born of utter hubris. I mean, you know, the notion that I would do all this research as a graduate student never really occurred to me as foolish, although in retrospect, it was profoundly expensive and time-consuming. But, you know, I was lucky in a way because, of course, well, not lucky, I did this on purpose. They're all English-speaking countries, so it smoothed my path into the archive. I could do multi-archival international research in a language with which I was eminently familiar. So that made the whole process less daunting. But it never crossed my mind not to do this work in this way. I mean, it seemed to me that at the time I was in graduate school, it was around 2005, 2006, you know, we were going through a number of important turns, the transnational turn, the multi-archival international turn in foreign relations scholarship. And it seemed to me you simply had to do this kind of work if you wanted to do justice to the history you were writing about, and more practically, if you wanted to get a job. So to me, that was a given. And as I said, Bill Keeler, my mentor, my advisor, never put the brakes on, so I never stopped. And I got lucky with my program providing funding at the right moments and making this possible. But that's, you know, all that sounds very exciting, and it was. But the thing I learned over the course of doing this that I never really realized was it can be quite alienating and unmooring to do this kind of work, because you know, the minute you step out of your disciplinary field specific network or world and you know, start moving into different subfields, it can be quite daunting. And you know, one of the things I've run into over the course of my career really is this guy really an American foreign relations historian? You know, this book is 75% British Empire. And, you know, as a graduate student, that never crossed my mind that might have implications professionally. I just saw it as, you know, I was following the trend of the field, and this is what the field was urging people to do, and the scholarship was urging people to do. So I did it. But the job market had not caught up with those changes. The you know, some departments had not caught up with those changes. You know, in many ways, the fields are still structured around these geographic specifications. So That turned out to be slightly more challenging than I anticipated. And by the same token, you know, as an American foreign relations historian, to be working in migration 10, 15 years ago, that was an unusual move. And my, there was a separate, and still is in many ways, a separate kind of migration history field. And you know, I wasn't necessarily going to all those conferences and networking with those individuals. And I felt like I wasn't really a foreign relations, American foreign relations historian anymore. And, you know, so it's it was an incredible experience to spend time in these kinds of places and do work in archives in these places. But by the same token, it can be somewhat alienating, I found. And maybe that's just me, but that's what I learned, I think, over the course of this.
Yeah, I agree with you about the sort of challenge navigating between the standard kind of geographical divisions in our field of history and sort of the more creative or innovative ways that people are starting to think beyond those boundaries. You know, it does seem to me, you know, some of my colleagues, you know, have started finding more successes, joining departments as international historians, and you know, come in as an international historian, have training in international history. So hopefully your story will be inspiring and useful to them as graduate students and early career scholars continue to move the needle in that regard.
Yeah, and I think that you're right. That's what's happening.
Yeah. The other sort of overarching question that I have about the book is about its organization. I think part of what's interesting to me is not only the research process for doing this multinational, multi-archival research is complex, but also then weaving the story together is also complicated. And just for our listeners, the book is, in addition to the intro and the conclusion, the book is organized into 7 chapters. The first 3 chapters look at Australia and New Zealand, look at South Africa and Canada and the U.S. respectively. And then chapter 4 kind of serves as a pivot that brings these threads together to think about why and how attempts to internationalize Asian exclusion ultimately fail. And then the final 3 chapters examine Asian exclusion during and after World War I, drawing from multiple locales within each of those chapters. So I wanted to sort of use that as a jumping off point to ask you about how you thought about organizing such a complicated project. You know, after you'd finished the research, how did you decide what the architecture of the book was going to look like?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Ian, and I'm delighted that you you saw there was actually an architecture in place. You know, it's when I started this project. Well, let me say this first. I'll tell you the listeners a very honest tale of how this became a book from a dissertation. When I started the dissertation, I went looking for transnational evidence of solidarity and collaboration among these different projects. I mean, that was what I was looking for, and I was driven by that transnational turn to go looking for transnationalism. So the dissertation had tried to kind of shoehorn some things in that I was never entirely comfortable with, and I'd also adopted a different analytical frame. I'd used whiteness, which we can talk about if you want to, which I subsequently jettisoned for a number of different reasons. So what happened after the dissertation was I had to revisit this book, as so many of us do, and decide what I was going to do with this. And I was uncomfortable that I'd not really found any kind of evidence, at least at the level I was looking at, which is the diplomatic international imperial governance level, that there was a great deal of collaboration, and that I wasn't seeing much more than actually tension and division along these lines. So I had to think about what I was going to do with that. And I kept coming back to the idea that this was a cautionary tale, in my view, about the transnational turn, about how we use and think about transnationalism. And I kept returning more and more to the question of contingency, that classic C of the five C's of historical study that we teach our students, right? And it struck me that there were a lot of contingencies that were mitigating, were prohibiting this kind of collaboration and solidarity that other scholars were beginning to talk about. And so that then translates into the first three chapters of the book. First three chapters that take a regional approach are really about trying to elucidate and explicate the myriad, I think, contingencies that are at play in each individual site. And I'm sure we'll talk about those in a little more detail later. And so that made sense then to kind of have that first part of the book be about, you know, what's different here? What's causing distinction? What's causing difference? Which is really what I stress in those first three chapters. And then, exactly as you say, chapter four became a moment where, okay, now let me step back and kind of take this story more global, more international, and start to think about how this plays out on the international scene and the kind of post the fallout from the 1907 riots in British Columbia and Washington State were a good opportunity to do that, as was Theodore Roosevelt's dispatch of the Great White Fleet and the circumnavigation of the world. That gave me an opportunity to kind of follow these strands out into the world. And then the war, of course, and the peace conference that follows. So it's about stepping back as an author, as a dissertator and an author to kind of think about what does this arc look like? What is, if you're going to do change over time, one of those other great seas of historical study, what does that change over time do to this story? And that's how I began to think about it, just to kind of think about the contingencies in the regions, and then step back and kind of flay this out and start to think about the global implications before. And, you know, I kind of return at the end to those contingencies, because that's what I see happening in 1921 to 24.
I hope that the folks who are listening, the listeners, will appreciate, hopefully, this first segment of our conversation, which is really about the craft of history for folks who are listening who are working again on their own projects, or perhaps graduate students, to sort of think about both how to do this kind of research, but then also how to put it together within a narrative. But as you've already started to help us think about the history and the substance of the research itself, perhaps we can pivot a little bit now to talk about the chapters themselves. And again, you know, one of the things I have to flag for our listeners is that, you know, it's such a rich book, it covers so much that it'll be impossible for us within the time that we have to really dig into the richness of the book. But I wonder if we could maybe start by talking about chapters 1, 2, and 3 almost together, because, as you said, you know, one of the things that you wanted to do within those first three chapters is to tell about the idiosyncrasies of each of these places. So the first chapter is about Australasia, the second chapter about South Africa, and then the third chapter about North America, specifically Canada and the United States. Can you tell us what is distinctive about each of these places in terms of how they react to the prospect or the reality of Asian mobility in the early 20th century?
So that, to me, was the most interesting thing about this story. The more I thought about it, the more I was working through these what I saw as the contingencies of each region. And trying to parse that and tease that out became part of the challenge of chapter 1, 2, and 3. So I think, you know, you can reasonably take Australasia, Australia and New Zealand, and think about them as having a particular set of contingencies, both regionally and then individually. So one of the things I stress in chapter 1 about Australasia is the geographical distance that they feel and have from Great Britain and from the center of international relations as it was in the imperial world at the time. So that you cannot escape when you look at primary sources during this period, especially around questions of Asian migration, you cannot escape this anxiety that New Zealanders and Australians, white New Zealanders and Australians, feel about being so far from Great Britain, so far from the Royal Navy by this time, and so close to Asia. And that geographic contingency is absolutely key to the way they think about this issue. you know, in New Zealand, you have a situation where there are very, very few Asian migrants, in fact, especially South Asian and Japanese, which is the focus of my book. They're just not there. They're not there. But what New Zealand is terrified of is that they will be there if they don't do something to prevent it. So in the New Zealand case, you're really looking at what I call a kind of prophylactic effort to prohibit, to prevent, to preempt any kind of movement. Whereas in Australia, you do actually have a lot more Japanese, to a lesser extent, South Asian immigrants by the turn of the century. So, you know, you've got to think about all these contingencies, I think. At the same time, you have the fact that very soon, just after they signed their own laws in 1901, in 1902, you get the Anglo-Japanese Alliance. And that the negotiations over that issue have been going on for the year preceding. So, you know, the international, the imperial situation is beginning to shift, and it's beginning to change in Japan's favor as far as the Australians and the New Zealanders are concerned. And there's a great sense of abandonment by the Australians and New Zealanders about what Britain is doing here, because they have to they can't project their naval power into the Pacific anymore and still protect, as they see it, the British home isles against, you know, a burgeoning German navy. So all those kind of contingencies, whether they're geographic, whether they're literally about the numbers of people, whether they're about the international and imperial politics, come into play, I think, in Australasia and kind of change the way things play out. It's a profoundly different situation in South Africa, and especially in the Transvaal colony, which is what I focus on here. And what I'm really interested in the South African case is the decision by the British government and the British High Commissioner in South Africa, Milner, Lord Milner, to import Chinese, to actively import Chinese indentured laborers. And this leads to an enormous imperial fight, argument between those who want to kind of rebuild the Transvaal and exploit the gold mines in particular by using indentured Chinese labor, and those, especially in Australia and New Zealand and across the white South African landscape, who feel like they've just fought a war to protect the whiteness of South Africa one way or another, and that's going to be sullied now by the importation of Chinese. So you have in the Transvaal just an incredibly different landscape when it comes to the imperial, colonial, international politics. You also have an entirely different racial landscape in South Africa. Of course, you've got minority white colonies that are just living and breathing this incredibly intense anxiety, racial anxiety about what they see as the kind of looming disaster of African takeover. You know, this is a constant feature. If the Australians are constantly worried about a Japanese invasion, then you have in white South Africa a similar constellation of fears around the, being suffused by this kind of black African mass. You see that a lot. And of course, this is a conquered colony. This is, the Transvaal is a conquered, defeated foreign power that is now a British colony and is being administered as such. So that creates a different range of political possibilities and economic possibilities and imperial issues that I think transect and intersect with the politics of Asian migration. So it's an entirely more complicated, complex, very different situation, and that informs the politics that will take place there when it comes to debating Asian migration. And then, of course, in the United States and Canada, once again, a completely different, in many respects, set of contingencies. You have a case here where you have a colony and a country that are actually united by a land border, which changes the complexion of the debate over Asian migration. And in my view, and in the view of, you know, other scholars, does actually facilitate at least a limited amount of transnational cooperation, at least initially. That's going to change after 1907, I argue, at least. But so you do have a kind of a unifying thread there, in that these are connected by land, and you do have a lot more Japanese in particular, but increasingly South Asian migrants moving through British Columbia, Washington, California, Oregon at this time. So that creates a different kind of politics, different kind of urgency. But, you know, I would also say that the British Columbian case and the Californian case, or the American case and the Canadian case, are also quite different from one another. As I've just hinted, you know, these are one's a colony, one's a country. So in the Canadian case, British Columbians cannot simply act against, you know, the federal government in Ottawa. They also have to be concerned about the British government across the Atlantic, which also has to be concerned about its new ally in Japan, which also has to be concerned about its prized colony in South Asia. So that's really kind of creating a different constellation of imperial and international and diplomatic considerations on all sides above the 49th parallel. And then in the United States, of course, there's a similar federal system, but there isn't that additional layer of authority. So that's kind of, I think in each case, I hope I've given some at least brief sense of just how complex the contingencies in each region are and how those contingencies, I think, inform the politics of the region. I think it's really important to pay attention to that.
That's a wonderful sort of recap of these different sets of contingencies. And I think one of the things that listeners will hopefully find really exciting about the book is the different scales at which these political questions move through from sort of local and state and provincial to national to regional to imperial. Perhaps we can dig a little bit now into each of those chapters or parts of them and follow up on some of these issues specifically. One of the and I want to start by asking you about the case of South Africa, because one of the critiques that pro-exclusion groups made about the indenture of Chinese laborers, that proposal that Milner put forward, was its essentially undemocratic nature, right? That in other words, such a significant policy should be left up to the people of the Transvaal colony and not up to a small group of political leaders and the landlords, the business leaders in South Africa. This struck me as one of the commonalities maybe across your case studies, where appointed executives maybe were more likely to exercise a kind of moderating influence compared to elective bodies. And I'm thinking specifically later in the book of U.S. Congress, the U.S. Congress in Chapter 7, that were responsive to other priorities. So to what extent, you sort of alluded to this earlier, in terms of the Transvaal being a conquered colony, to what extent do you see forms of political institutions mattering in terms of the sort of moderate versus completely reactionary impulses around Asian exclusion?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, in terms of the Transvaal, as you say, this is a conquered colony with essentially an occupation government in place, foisted upon the colony by the British government in London. And you know, Milner's such a high-handed character. He is determined, absolutely determined, to import Chinese indentured labor, because as far as he's concerned, that is the absolute key to the success of Transvaal as a British colony. If you can get the gold flowing, then you can bring in his view, more white settlers, which will then solve the Boer problem, which will then generate connections with the British metropole, which will then increase the economic value of the colony, and so on and so forth. So you've got this great irony that Chinese indentured laborers are, in Milner's view, the key to increasing the white population and the Anglo-white population specifically of the Transvaal and therefore South Africa. You know, that is inconceivable anywhere else in the British Empire that's governed by an independent legislature, as Australia and New Zealand are. You know, that kind of action would have been, as I say, inconceivable. By the same token, you know, you have this intervention by especially Richard Seddon, the New Zealand Prime Minister, who is kind of operating on the notion that the British Empire functions as a democracy. that the British Empire exists, especially as far as white men are concerned, especially as far as the white dominions are concerned, as they're beginning to be called by this point. You know, these are self-governing white settlements. White countries increasingly, and they want a say in the empire. And that's one of the great kind of overarching issues that's in the background of all of this book, really, is about what's that relationship going to be? How much democracy, in essence, will there be in a British imperial sense? There's talk about federation and commonwealth and all that at the time. So I think, you know, you have these white leaders in quasi-democracies in Australia and New Zealand who think that the empire is running on that level, at least as far as white men are concerned. And the British government simply is not willing to entertain that notion in the Transvaal. This is a conquered colony, and it will be exploited as such until such time as it becomes self-perpetuating. And that's one of the central tensions between certainly New Zealand and Britain during this period over the question of the importation of Chinese. So I think it matters a great deal. But I would also say, you know, the federal systems of North America create some really interesting politics that complicate this too. You know, as I've suggested in my previous answer, you know, we have a situation where you have multiple layers of authority in many of these places, but especially in North America. You have, you know, provinces and states, but you also then have federal governments, which are often very far from the provinces and states where Asian migration is a concern. And then you have, of course, in Canada, another layer of authority in the British government, which ultimately retains suzerainty over some very key issues, foreign policy being one of them. So you've got these layers of authority within the British Empire and within even individual colonies that I think are really complicating for those who wish to just simply carte blanche and explicitly and racially reject Chinese migration. I should say Asian migration.
And I think one of the things that you then sort of help us to understand is how, you know, in the case of South Africa, it's sort of an imposition of the indenture. Lord Milner, you know, sees this as the way forward and has imperial support for it. In places like Australia and New Zealand, you see a different sort of policy solution that comes up to Asian mobility. And this is the Natal formula, Natal being also of South African connected to South Africa, I should say. Can you tell us a little bit about the Natal formula and how it works to expose sort of these kinds, both expose and then repair or paper over these imperial divisions, and how it compares to other policy solutions that we begin to see around Asian migrations during this period?
So, you know, the British see it exactly the way you've just described it. This is an opportunity to paper over and repair some of these burgeoning imperial tensions, intra-imperial tensions, but also international tensions that are emerging over Asian migration. And the British figure, you know, this is a perfect solution. So the Natal formula essentially was a literacy test. And other scholars have traced this actually back to the United States and some of the literacy tests that were imposed on African-American voting in the South. And that this became then a solution to migration issues in the South African colony of Natal. So what would happen essentially in the Australian case is you would be required to pass a literacy test, an education test, they called it, to even more disguise what its actual intent was. If you were anybody immigrating to Australia on Natal, you'd have to pass a literacy test. Now, what this would be is it would entirely depend upon the immigration officer. The immigration officer would look at me, for instance, as a white English-speaking male and give me a literacy test in English and ask me to basically copy out a 50-word paragraph to show that I was educated, literate enough to be able to copy this passage. If they saw that I was a Japanese individual who was looking to immigrate to Australia, they would not give me a Japanese paragraph, and they likely wouldn't give me an English paragraph either, because there was a pretty good chance that a Japanese person, certainly of a higher education and status in Japan, would know English. So what you end up with is the Japanese individual or the South Asian individual would be tested in Greek or Czech, or in some cases you even have Cornish or Welsh, languages that no one could ever be expected to know. And that way they could be denied entry to Australia or Natal on the basis of education and literacy rather than race. Of course, the immigration officer is judging how to make that happen. So from the perspective of the British, this is brilliant. This is perfect, because this is colorblind. This is simply a literacy test, which is, not uncommon across the globe in all kinds of contexts. And that way you don't upset the Japanese by explicitly racially excluding them. And in fact, the Japanese actually were not averse to this as a solution to this problem. They had indicated their willingness to accept this because it wouldn't bring with it the stain of racial exclusion. That's the biggest concern they had. They didn't want to be kind of treated as racially distinct. This is an era in which Japan is a burgeoning regional power, at least in East Asia, and is beginning to see itself as an imperial power, and one that ought to have some level of equality with the great European powers in the United States. So from their perspective, too, this is a good solution. The problem is, as far as the Australians are concerned in their parliament, this isn't good enough. This isn't going to be strict enough. It's much better, according to almost half of the Australian parliament, it's much better to say what you want to do. Let's just be honest here. We do not want non-white immigrants coming into Australia, and we should set our immigration policy along those lines explicitly, so that we don't have a problem down the line. And once we've kind of ripped this band-aid off and offended Japan, they'll get over it and we'll ensure the whiteness of Australia. So this is kind of that's a central debate that I describe in chapter one that's going on here, that Australians aren't arguing about whether or not to ban Asian migrants. They are arguing over how to do it. Are they going to do it in a way that satisfies Britain and Japan, or are they going to do it in an explicitly racial way that satisfies those who are intent upon making the first act of Australian national life a racial one, to create a white Australia? So it's not quite the salve that the British imagine it to be, because it's almost immediately rejected by half the Australian Parliament. Now, as it turns out, enough people vote on in favour of the Natal formula that does become the basis of the so-called white Australia policy, and the same in New Zealand. And they're under great pressure, the Australian government is and the New Zealand government is, from the British government and indeed the Japanese government at the time. And so that becomes the mode of restriction. But that's not going to be a long-lasting one in the case of New Zealand. And it's not what happens in North America. The Canadians actually reject that formula. They don't want a literacy test. They come up with a couple of different solutions to that, one being, as far as the Japanese are concerned, they follow the American lead and establish a diplomatic relationship with Japan that results in a gentleman's agreement that Japan agrees to limit the number of people it will allow to leave and come to Canada. And from the Canadian perspective, I think, they see themselves as having and seeking a relationship with Japan, especially a commercial relationship. That's high on everyone's agenda in the Canadian government at this time. And so they don't want to treat with Japan as a diplomatic issue. I think that's part of what's going on there, why they reject the literacy test and adopt instead this diplomatic formula. And then when it comes to South Asian migrants, the Canadians come up with the continuous journey resolution, which stipulates that if you want to immigrate to Canada, you have to make a continuous journey from start to finish from your homeland, from your place of birth to Canada. And while that's quite easy for someone coming from Europe, especially Britain, it is impossible for someone coming from India, since there is no continuous passage from India to British Columbia. You simply can't do it. You've got to change ships or stop off in Hong Kong. You've got to refuel. You've got to take on new passengers, Singapore. So there is no continuous journey, and that's a ruse they use to get over that. So again, you know, the British think they've got this thing solved early on in 1897 with the Natal formula, and it's far more complicated, as it turns out, on the ground.
I think one of the sort of themes that emerges for me out of all of these different policy solutions that are crafted to navigate between this tension between local needs and imperial priorities is, I think, as you say, one point, the kind of duplicitousness of it, right? The duplicity of it, that it needs to be seen as non-racial in character because it can't offend the Japanese Empire. But it still needs to sort of do or achieve the results that the Australians or the Canadians want. And some might see that as a kind of creative policy solutions or creative policy making. And I suppose that would be a generous reading of this history. But I think those case studies are really helpful to understanding, you know, sort of current policies and sort of how we might critically uncover, you know, what is actually, you know, at work. What is this, for example, colorblindness, as you said, you know, what does that actually mean? Since you brought up the continuous journey rule, I think maybe we can jump to chapter five and talk about the Komagatamaru incident, which some listeners may remember is the steamship that a South Asian activist named Baba Gurdit Singh organized to challenge that policy. And listeners may also recall that Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada, apologized for the incident in the House of Commons in 2016. But this incident stood out to me because it's an episode that highlights the ways in which Asian migrants and activists often took matters into their own hands in opposition to the desires and the policies of high-ranking government officials. So I wonder if you can speak a little bit as to how we think about the role of ordinary people in the story, right? Because we have the cast of characters are overwhelmingly, I think, focused on ambassadors and high commissioners and secretaries of state. How do we sort of fit the ordinary migrant or activist like Baba Gurdit Singh into this history?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, so there's two things that I had to kind of do when I was conceiving of this project. For me, there hadn't been enough attention paid to the diplomatic level, to the international level, to the state level. That seems like a counterintuitive thing to say, given that we've had 100 years of historiography that's done only that, right? But I think there was a lot of scholarship when I started doing this project. There'd been a lot of scholarship that had done incredible work to excavate and uncover the role of ordinary people, and especially migrants in restoring agency to their migratory experience and to challenge many of these state policies. And there'd just been a profusion of work that was just unbeatably good. I mean, I'm sure you've discussed some of this stuff with the authors over the years, and I'm thinking of Erica Lee's work and Andrea Geiger's work, and there's just Cornell Chang, and there's just been a tremendous amount of work that already did this. And what that work did for me was it allowed me to revisit, I think, and this is my argument and I'm sticking to it, it allowed me to go back and revisit then what that meant for the state, what that meant for the empire, what that meant for the international level. So I intentionally kind of kept it at that level of analysis because I just felt like, you know, A, that work had been done and it had been done extremely well, and B, it had uncovered for me then all new kinds of avenues to explore. The Komagatamaru case is one where I think, you know, Singh is kind of a central character, and it does illustrate how important individual migrants were and their experiences were. And I think, you know, he's one of the arguments I make in the book is a lot of the historiography, a lot of the literature, not just on migration, but on any kind of foreign relations or international relations history, especially during this period, is really focused on flows and conduits and mobility and this kind of imagery, these kinds of metaphors. And what I was struck by revisiting the story is that, you know, that these were the actions of these white male administrators were in many ways, you know, the reaction to that mobility, to that flow, to that to those conduits. And I wanted to kind of explore that again, having had the benefit of all this other scholarship. So for me, you know, I would have to have done a quite different archival research to uncover the voices of the individual migrants. It would have greatly changed the nature of the research in the book, I think, in a way that would have just made it too much for a dissertation. And frankly, there was so much good work on that already. I saw this as an opportunity to go back. I mean, you know, I have the occasional episode where you see the voices of individual migrants. I found a great document which had a petition from the state of Victoria, representatives there, Indian migrants that had petitioned the Crown to basically stop the Australian government from imposing these kinds of restrictions on fellow subjects of the British Empire. And they're very clear about the kind of pain and hurt that this is causing them as fellow British subjects, you know, and how can we be treated like this? So that's a kind of very poignant, I think, document. And of course, that's what you get from looking at these kinds of levels. It's a completely different level of analysis.
Yeah, and of course, as you said, you know, this kind of work is an ongoing conversation, you know, in terms of revisions to, you know, the sort of new social history and kind of bringing the state back in or the empire back in once we've fleshed out that story. With the time that we have left, I wonder if we can maybe concentrate on as we look at the end of the book, chapters 6 and 7. These are the chapters that deal with what happens to Asian mobility and the restriction of Asian mobility after World War I. The story there is, as you tell it, that you know, Japan was an ally to Great Britain and had been very forceful participants and thought that they deserved certain amounts of leeway and accommodation in the aftermath of having participated in that conflict. But that's not what happens. And same is true for South Asians, of course, who had fought in World War I as well. But in neither of those cases does that turn out to be true. And you write about the three sets of conferences that occur: the Imperial War Conferences in London in 1917 and 1918, the Peace Conference in Paris in 1919, and then the Naval Conference in Washington D.C. in 1921. Again, all kinds of creative policymaking to skirt around the issue of South Asian and Japanese desires for mobility. What are the issues that come out of World War I, and how do people make policy around these tensions and continue to restrict Asian mobility?
Yeah, it's one of my favorite chapters because I think I was able to do some things by taking this kind of multi-archival approach that really enriched the story we have of a very familiar period in history, of course. So just to go back to chapter 5 briefly, the rest of chapter 5 after the Komagata Maru episode talks about the deteriorating relationship between Australia and Japan, who are now allies in World War I. And I really trace this kind of, you know, they start off flush with the possibility of alliance, and then it quickly transpires that, you know, racism and Australian racial policy is gonna be a huge schism in that relationship. So by the time we get to the Paris Peace Conference, it's going to be the Australian representative, the Australian Prime Minister, William Morris Hughes, who's going to come to the fore, and he becomes my muse in trying to figure out what happened there. And you know, Hughes is one of these characters in this book that I just became utterly fascinated by. He's a bombastic, dynamic, irascible, unpleasant and endlessly fascinating individual. And so it was a real treat to be able to get into his papers and some of the British papers and some of the Australian government papers about what he did at Paris. And I really tell the story through the lens of his experience. And essentially, you know, the Australian Prime Minister takes on the burden of essentially preventing Japan from achieving equality at Paris. The Japanese put forward what comes to be known as the Racial Equality Amendment that they hope to put into the League of Nations Covenant that Wilson and others are negotiating. And it starts off, you know, a fairly bold statement of racial equality, but as it runs into opposition from the British delegation and especially Hughes, they soften it a couple of times, and it becomes eventually a very innocuous, watered-down statement of just everyone's equal and we should treat them as such. But Hughes cannot allow that to happen because he's terrified that if that becomes part of the League of Nations covenant to which Australia is a party, they're going to lose control over immigration policy and they're going to lose the ability to restrict immigration. And so he just goes absolutely apoplectic around Paris, being extremely vocal in opposition to any attempt to A, impose limits on Australian immigration policy, but B, admit any kind of racial equality for non-whites. And of course, the subtext of all of this is he's not alone. I mean, he's representing the voice of his South African compatriots, especially Jan Christian Smuts, who takes on a very imposing role in Paris. He's representing the New Zealand position, the Canadian position, the British position. I mean, the British can't readily admit racial equality when they have an empire largely of non-white people. And of course, Woodrow Wilson, the American president, has no intention of yielding to this because he's under incredible pressure from the Californians in particular to not allow this to happen. And Hughes actually goes to quite often to the California press representatives in Paris to keep them apprised of what's happening, to keep the pressure on Wilson. And so, you know, Hughes takes on this burden of ensuring the rejection of the Racial Equality Amendment, and in doing so, really incurs the ire of the Japanese and the Japanese people more broadly. And as we go through this chapter, you start to see the kind of repercussions of Hughes's politics here. And you know, there's a great deal of tension rising in Australian-Japanese relations as we move towards the end of the chapter. So much so that you know, when he gets back to Australia, he's triumphant and declares that, you know, the white Australia policy is yours, you may do with it as you will. And then immediately starts, you know, cabling the British in London, send me more ships, I'm worried the Japanese are going to attack. So he's really caused a great deal of difficulty for his country here by being so vocal and so bold. And you see evidence in the book of other representatives who certainly agreed with him but kept their mouths shut because they realized they didn't have to take on that burden. He was willing to do it for them. So to me, that was a fascinating story of this stuff, of a racial exponent like Hughes shooting himself in the foot, shooting his dominion in the foot by pursuing this kind of politics so noisily and so blithely and confidently. And then when you get to the Washington Naval Conference in 21-22, all of a sudden you have Australians and New Zealanders petitioning the British government to keep the Anglo-Japanese alliance in place because they've alienated them so much they would much rather have an ally aggrieved at them than a non-ally aggrieved at them, which subsequently is what happens. And the United States is putting enormous pressure on Britain to jettison the Anglo-Japanese alliance. And by this time, Japan, there's a lot of sentiment in Japan that this alliance has run its course. But it's actually William Morris Hughes and Massey Ferguson in New Zealand who are pushing the British government to keep this. So you have this kind of, you know, incredible confidence and hubris when you start off in this case that culminates in a complete reversal by the Australasians. So it's a moment, I think, where, you know, there is a great deal of duplicity and deceit going on, and those are words I use a lot. you have this moment where Hughes actually kind of jettisons all of that and goes on a rampage through Paris, and you see the consequences, and it really backfires on him.
Well, then that brings us to the seventh chapter, and you end the book in the early 1920s. The seventh and final chapter of the book talks about what you call the final significant outbreak of white activism against Japanese, South Asian, and Chinese mobility from 1920 to 1924. And U.S. historians will be familiar with the Immigration Act of 1924. To me, the most riveting part of this chapter, I have to say, was the story you tell about how Secretary of State Charles Evan Hughes and the Japanese ambassador, Hanahara, seemingly almost by accident, bring about the end of the gentleman's agreement. You know, and this is one of these kind of examples of contingencies. And I'm not sure that it's a story that's really well known. And it's important, of course, as you say in the chapter, because it leads to or introduces this principle of sovereignty as the sort of overarching principle by which immigration restriction will be determined. Can you tell us that story and why it's significant to this history?
Yeah, it's a remarkable story. I mean, what you have, of course, in the United States by 1924 is a sentiment of immigration restriction that goes beyond Asian immigration. And there is a great deal of support for that position in the Congress. So, you know, I don't want to give the impression that Hanahara and Lodge are entirely responsible for this, if we were trending in that direction. But what happens essentially is, as we start to think about national origins quotas, the conversation turns to finally now, not explicitly, but overtly, in one way or another, preventing Japanese immigration now and tearing up essentially the gentleman's agreement that had been in place since 1908. The Congress is deeply uncomfortable with, or certain members of Congress are deeply uncomfortable with, the gentleman's agreement because it didn't exist in treaty, essentially. It was an executive agreement, and therefore there was never a treaty in place that they could look at or call on to defend this arrangement. So, Senate, you know, there's members of Congress that are just trying to get rid of it and replace it with something that can actually they can point to as an ironclad principle. So what they come up with, of course, is this concept of aliens ineligible for citizenship that was based on some recent Supreme Court cases that had determined that if you were ineligible for United States citizenship, then you could be and should be restricted from entering the United States as an immigrant. And that was essentially based on the principle that if you were not white nor African American, as the American law stated, and now the Constitution stated, that you should not be allowed to come into the United States because you couldn't naturalize. And that goes back to a couple of cases in 22, 21. So the Congress kind of seizes on that as, again, another deceit, another fiction that they can apply now to the Japanese. All other Asian peoples have already been essentially prohibited from entering the United States by this point. The Japanese are the lone national group that still has this slight opening under the gentleman's agreement. And so Congress determines to create what some people call Japanese exclusion. It's technically not. It's an aliens ineligible for citizenship clause that will apply to the Japanese because everyone else is either covered by something else or restricted by something else. Of course, the American Secretary of State, Charles Evans Hughes, is determined to retain this agreement. He understands what it means to Japan. He understands the problems it will cause if they unilaterally rip it up and get rid of it. And so he works closely with the Japanese ambassador, Hanahara, to write essentially what they think is a measured and responsible response from the Japanese government. And Hanahara writes this memo. It's about 12 or 13 pages long, if I recall correctly, outlining a very well-stated, well-argued legal case, essentially, one based in international law that you know, and also makes the point that the Japanese are well aware of what Congress is up to now. There's no secret here that they're using the aliens ineligible for citizenship clause to work around Japanese exclusion. But there is a line in there. There is a line in there, and it's just completely innocuous in context. Well, it's not innocuous, but it's certainly meant innocuously in context, that indicates there will be grave consequences for American Japanese relations if Japanese are going to be unilaterally rejected. Again, that's a fairly reasonable statement if you think about it. There will be grave consequences if Japanese American relations are to turn. And so Congress really seizes on that, and opponents of Japanese immigration really seize on that to essentially claim that Japan has threatened the United States. And all of a sudden, you've got a lot of senators who are wary of tearing up the agreement, who suddenly come on board and announce their great disgust for Japanese threats. It really has the air of a manufactured crisis. It was not what Hanahara, and it certainly wasn't what Hughes intended. And you have a lot of efforts by Hanahara and Hughes to kind of to point this out, and it goes nowhere, unfortunately. And all of a sudden, you end up with now aliens ineligible for citizenship going into the new immigration law, and effectively banning Japanese immigration. So it is a tremendously poignant story. You know, Hanahara resigns and goes back to Japan just a broken man. I mean, it's tremendously poignant. And again, he's basically taken advantage of, I think, by members of Congress who were determined to append this gentleman's agreement that they did not see as ironclad enough or tangible enough to ensure complete Japanese exclusion in an era of intense nativism. I mean, this is without question, as I'm sure your listeners know, a moment of great xenophobia and nativism in the United States. They're fighting against the tide, both of them here.
Well, I think, unfortunately, we are running out of time. There's so much more that I would love to talk to you about, David, about this book. I think it's important to maybe wrap up for our listeners to know that, you know, at least from my point of view, the title of the book is really wonderful in how it communicates the message of the book. The burden of supremacy, of white supremacy, obviously is carried by the people who are excluded. That's, I think, a given. But I think that, as you point out, through so many different case studies and examples over three continents, through four continents, that the burden of white supremacy also fell on the nations and the empires themselves, who were trying to struggle with these white supremacist feelings and ways to manage them, that it caused great discord and great disharmony, required all kinds of, again, creative, duplicitous, policymaking, and ended up with, in some cases, really poignant stories like Hanahara of people who are just broken by this system and this work around Asian exclusion and restriction. I think as we conclude, though, David, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on now and what listeners might look forward to if they enjoyed The Burden of White Supremacy.
Well, it's a slightly more fun topic for me, at least. But it's going to unfortunately mean I never come back on this particular podcast, because I'm moving away from migration now. My new work is going to be a book on imports to the United States in the 19th century, kind of roughly from 1812 to 1914. And I'm taking a very thematic approach to imports. I'm moved by what I think is another long overdue move in American foreign relations scholarship that encourages us to look at what the world does to America, not just what America does to the world. And in that respect, migration, there's a link with migration, right? Clearly, you know, migration to the United States infuses and influences the United States with global influence. And so now I'm going to turn to imports. I'm incredibly inspired by some recent work. Kristen Hogenson's book, Consumers Imperium, is a brilliant, brilliant exploration of women in the Midwest, middle-class women in the upper Midwest at the turn of the century, 20th century. who are engaging with imports and what they make of them, what they think about them, what they do with them, what they use them for, what it makes them experience, and how it makes them think about Americans' place in the world, and especially the place of women in the world. And I'm interested in kind of stretching that out and thinking more broadly about how imports to the United States affect, influence American society, American diplomacy, American economy, of course, in all kinds of different ways. So that's something I'm pursuing now. You know, it's been a tremendously invigorating study so far. I'm having a lot of fun. It's a lot less heavy than, you know, I'm sure a lot of your listeners will know who study this stuff. It has a kind of what I like to call a Clockwork Orange quality to it. I mean, you spend your days you know, reading some deeply unpleasant material and listening to the rantings and ravings of some deeply racist individuals. So it's actually been quite nice to get away from that and start thinking about imports. I would also like to point out, by the way, that this may sound all terribly venal, but I am not chasing Donald Trump. I'm not the historical equivalent of an ambulance chaser here. I keep coming up with these topics and then suddenly they become current events. And that was not my intention with either of these projects, but unfortunately they are. And I guess it shows the abiding significance of migration and importation and Americans' engagement with the world. And some of these things just haunt us throughout our history.
Well, I think it's helpful to still, regardless, have that historical context, obviously, for these questions. So I appreciate the work that you did for the Burden of White Supremacy. I look forward to hearing more about that project in the future. And most of all, David, I want to thank you for being on the show today. I really enjoyed our conversation and getting to read the book. So thank you again.
I appreciate it a great deal. Thanks for having me, Ian, and thanks to everybody for listening.
That was my conversation with Professor David Atkinson of Purdue University about his book, The Burden of White Supremacy, Containing Asian Migration in the British Empire and the United States, published in 2016 by the University of North Carolina Press. I'm Ian Shin, and this is New Books in Asian American Studies. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next time.